So today I'm going to go into a bit more detail about the spectrum of the superstring theories and discuss difference in superstring theories. So at the end of the last lecture, we arrived to some description of the spectrum of closed strings. There were four sectors. And if you look, if there were no tachyons, and there was massless, there were massless degrees of freedom coming from all the sectors. So from the SNS sector, we found states which we tentatively identified with the graviton, B field, and dilaton, the same way as for the bosonic string. In the NSR and RNS sectors, we found gravitinis, so spin 3 half fields, which have both a Spinor index that come from the Ramon ground states, and the vector index, which are the hallmark of supergravity. So that are supersymmetric versions of gravitons. And finally, in the RR sector, we found something strange. We found some bosonic fields which had two Spinor indices, which is usually not something that you commonly encounter, at least not in this form. It's useful to look at the Rochelle condition for these fields, sort of the linearized equation of motion. Here we had the usual B squared equal to zero. And then you can, as you can guess, you get the usual constraints, and this should be that the polarization should be transverse to the momentum and that longitudinal mode of the couple. Here, so this one, if you remember, comes from the condition L0 minus ANS acting on your state should be zero. So this is 1/2. Now, in the, and of course the same condition for a zero bar. When you, in the R sector, the supercurrent also has zero modes. So when you expand in the Ramon sector, you find modes, various modes, including a G0. Now, if you remember, G was equal to psi mu dx mu, which means that when you start expanding G0, you find things like psi 0 mu p mu plus double dots. And these ones are gamma matrices when they act on the Ramon states. So among the conditions for BST invariance of this state, there is both P squared equal to zero, but there is also G0 bar acting on it equal to zero, which gives you P mu psi bar mu zero acting on the state equal to zero. This is a Dirac equation. So this is the standard. You know, if you do a Fourier transform of this, you get something like box equal to zero. I'm not sure I'm not supposed to write up there. Sorry. If a Fourier transform this and you rewrite this as a gamma matrix, you get something like this, which is a Dirac equation. Okay? So that's very familiar. But fermions, we have first order differential equations. It makes sense. And then this one actually implies this. It's a form of supersymmetry. G0 squared is actually equal to L0 minus some contribution from the Casimir energy. Now, same thing here. But here, we find something interesting. Although these are bosonic fields, we find two first order equations. So a set of bosonic fields come with two spinor indices and satisfy two Dirac equations, one for each spinor index. Now they really look exotic. But if you look at the simple four-dimensional example, maybe they will start looking less exotic. Consider electromagnetism in 4D. And suppose that you had a situation in which, for some reason, you want to be able to talk about both electric particles, electrical charged particles, and magnetic monopoles. The situation where you have both an electric current and a magnetic current. Now, in such a situation, you cannot use the gauge connection to describe your theory, simply because the equations of motions become d star f equal star of your electric current, but also df equal star of your magnetic current. So it's much more reasonable to work in terms of the field strengths, to work in terms of electric field and magnetic field. And these equations have a neat symmetry, which exchanges electric and magnetic currents, and f and star f, and e and m. It sends e and b. So the electric field and the magnetic field. Sends electric field to the magnetic field, and the magnetic field to minus the electric field. If you look at the Maxwell equations, this is a neat symmetry. Well, there are probably some i's. I don't think so. Sorry. This should be fine. Okay. So if you want to have a description which allows you to think about electromagnetic duality, to treat electric charges and magnetic charges on the same footing, then you need to work in terms of F. And now your equations of motions are two first order equations of motions. Indeed, if you consider the you can define sort of dual combinations of the field strand in its dual. Call them F plus minus. And it's useful. They actually have a nice description in terms of spinors. So a way to think about it is that if a true form carries the same indices as a Lorentz generator. Lorentz generators are something that can act on spinors. So Lorentz generators, in particular, can be built out of gamma matrices. So there are matrices which implement Lorentz generators on spinners of both chiralities. Spinners, left-handed spinners go to left-handed spinners and you rotate them. Right-handed spinners go to right-handed spinners and you rotate them. And actually, it turns out that when acting on left-handed spinners, the Lorentz generators are self-dual. And when acting on right-handed spinners, the Lorentz generators are anti-self-dual. So you can use these matrices to sort of change of basis and write F plus as something with two chiral spinor indices, and F minus as something with two anti-chiral spinor indices. Actually, you can raise lower indices with anti-symmetric tensor. So you can also write this as F plus alpha beta and F minus alpha dot beta dot. Now, notice that F mu has six components in four dimensions. F plus minus have three components each. When you write them like that, these three components are simply two spinor indices, traceless. Sorry, symmetric. Symmetric. So these are turned out to be symmetric in the two indices. Another way to think about this. So, and these equations written in terms of these fields become just Dirac operators acting on the two indices. So the situation is completely analogous to what's going on over there. Another way to think about it is if you take the product of spinor representations of opposite chirality in four dimensions, you get a vector. So something that has alpha and alpha dot indices can be converted into something that has mu indices. On the other hand, if you take the product of two spinors of the same chirality, you can separate these into symmetric and anti-symmetric part. So this four is really 3 plus 1. And this is a scalar, and this is a self-dual true form. So this contains a kernel of truth that is true in any number of dimensions. In any number of dimensions, the product of two spinor indices can be rewritten, can be decomposed into a direct sum of objects which have anti-symmetric powers of vector indices. So let's play the game, the numerology game in 10 dimensions. I mean, one way to think about it is that the dimension, if you have an anti-symmetric tensor in D dimensions with K indices, the number of components given by the binomial DK. Is this readable from over there? Okay. So if I sum over K of all possible sizes, D choose K, I'm going to get to the D. And the dimension of a spinor representation usually is like something like 2 to the d minus 1 or 2 to the d minus 2, depending on how your the details of your dimensionality. Now, sorry, I mean d over 2, 2 to the d over 2, roughly. So the dimension of a spin representation is roughly 2 to the d over 2. A way to understand that is that you can start with your gamma matrices and pair them up to things like gamma 1 plus I gamma 2, gamma 3 plus I gamma 4, etc. Okay. And these objects anti-commute with each other and square to 0. and it makes sense to look for a vector which is annihilated by all of them. These are like these destruction operators. And then you can build on that vector by acting with gamma 1 minus I gamma 2, gamma 3 minus I gamma 4, etc., which are again a second set of matrices which square to 0 and anti-commute. So to describe a spinner in a convenient way, or at least to count the dimension of a spinner representation in the dimensions, you look for a vector which is annihilated by these guys, and then you act on it with these guys. You can act at most once with each of these guys because they square to 0. And so you get 2 to the d over 2. Okay, so very roughly, the product of two spinners ends up being a sum of anti-symmetric powers of the vector representation. Now, we can do a bit more numerology, which is a little bit more specific to the problem at hand, which is 10 dimensions. What are the dimensions, what are the binomials, what are the dimensions of representations that you build out of anti-symmetric powers? So I have a scalar. I have a 10-dimensional representation, which is a single vector index. I have something with two indices, which has 10 times 9 divided by 2, 45 components. Then I have 45 times 8 divided by 3, 120 components for a tensor with three vector indices. Then 120 times 7 divided by 4, 210. Which are the components of a tensor with four anti-symmetric indices. And then I take this times 6 divided by 5, and I get something which has, 126. But I'm going to take the, so this can be split into sort of a self-dual, in two self-dual components, each of which is 126. Okay, and then if you keep going, you get again 210 for something which has 6 indices, and then 120 for something with 7 indices, and then 45, something with 8 indices, 10, and 1. Okay? So let's look at some dimensions here. So 10 plus 120 plus 126 equals 256. 1 plus 45 plus 210 equals 256. I'm going to claim that one of these is the product of two spinors of the same chirality, and the other is the product of two spinors of different chirality. Can you guess which? Well, let's see. Something that has the same chirality should be something we can split into even, into symmetric and anti-symmetric parts. So if I have two 16-dimensional indices, what is the symmetric combination of two 16-dimensional indices? 16 times 17 divided by 2. And then there is the anti-symmetric combination, which is 16 times 15 divided by 2. So these are 120, 136. So this is the one that can be split into symmetric and anti-symmetric. So this is a tensor A, the index, bad name, sorry, let me call it 16 left times 16 left, and this is 16 left times 16 right. Notice also that if you do 16 left and 16 left, you're going to get self-dual stuff. If you do 16 right and 16 right, you're going to get anti-self-dual stuff. Okay. So we can go back here. So out of these, we are going to get a vector, a something with 3 components, and something with 5 components. So field strength, which we call, which you could call F1, F3, F5. Although it's very useful to think about really a whole set of field strengths that keeps going to 7 and 9, with the idea that F1 is just the dual of F9, F3 is just the dual of F7, and F5 is the dual of itself. So this is the type should be string theory. The fact that it includes a self-dual field is actually a bit makes it actually tricky to write down things like actions. So for the non-self-dual fields, we can take this F1, write in terms of a connection, write down a nice action. F5 is always a little bit of an outlier. Because it's self-dual, we cannot write a connection for it easily. But anyway, it's better to just have this sort of uniform perspective. And here, we get F2 being the same as star F8. You get F, well, you also get F0. I'll go back to it in a moment. And then F4 being equal to star F6. So in type 2A, there is a standard gauge field. No, a field strength with 2 indices. And a gauge field with 3 indices. So something that I would like to couple to three-dimensional object. And then there is this. Now, a field strength without any indices is actually something a bit spurious. If you look at the equation of motion, it's constant. So it's not a propagating degree of freedom, but it matters for some problems. On the other hand, on type 2B side, this one-dimensional field strength is just the gradient of a scalar field. So this gives you something called the axiom. And then there is a sort of a two-form version of a gauge field and a four-form version of a gauge field, which would like to couple to things that have like strings or four-dimensional objects. The same way as this wants to couple to one to particles, one-dimensional objects. Now, at this stage, nothing is really charged under these fields. If you look at the closed string scattering amplitude, and you put one of these Ramon-Ramon fields, there is essentially it's actually not completely obvious. Definitely, sorry, I was going to say something is actually not obviously true. So I was going to say that, so because the Ramon-Ramon fields give you antiperiodic boundary conditions for the fermions, they always have to come in pairs. If you have a only an SNS fields and a single Ramon field, then this amplitude is just zero. You cannot even define the fermionic path integral or something like that, because the fermion wants to be antiperiodic around here, but it cannot be antiperiodic around a single point of the of your surface and periodic around everything else. So you can never find a diagram where there is some NS string which exchanges a single Ramon field. So the Neville-Schwarz fields are not charged under the Ramon fields. And Ramon fields always end up in pairs in the effective action. Now, loophole with this argument that I just see now and I didn't prepare for, is that I could imagine perhaps having RR, RNS, and NSR. So at the moment, I don't remember how to continue the argument. But let's just say that there is a lack of objects which are naturally charged under this field strength. I mean, it might be possible to create some dipole sort of multiple modes, multiple sources for this. But, you know, the very basic coupling that you expect to see in an effective action when you have an F3, say, is that F3 equals to DHU, and there is some object, some two-dimensional object. Some two-dimensional object over which this HU is integrated. The same way as if I have a particle, a charged particle, I expect, you know, I get a coupling to the gauge field that looks like that. Now, we will amend this momentarily by considering D-brains. So we'll see that D-brains are actually sources, natural sources for these Ramon fields. Now, I would also like to stress out that the low energy theories that you find in this type 2A and type 2B string theories, which are some sort of supergravities, are completely constrained by supersymmetry. So people knew how to write down an action or equations of motions for these fields right away, before they studied string theory, superstring theory, just because these are examples of supergravities. And in every dimension, there is just a handful of possible supergravities you can write down. Indeed, this pretty much exhausts the list of supergravities in 10 dimensions with this amount of supersymmetry. Now, I would like to use the second half of the lecture to discuss D-brains. So we need to answer the two sort of questions. Which fields are sourced by D-brain? By putting it at time equal to zero in the cylinder. And which open strings live between D-brains in superstring theory with a strip geometry? So, in order to answer these questions, we need to understand what boundary conditions can we impose on our fermions and our bosons. Well, so the boundary conditions have to, as usual, relate T and T bar at the boundary. And as you can guess, they also have to relate G and G bar at the boundary. This is a condition to have super diffeomorphism. This is a condition to have diffeomorphism and Walling invariance of a boundary condition. The super diffeomorphism and super wild invariance require the G at the boundary should be equal to plus or minus G bar at the boundary. Now, in terms of the, so because T was dx mu dx mu, the way we implemented these boundary conditions in the T-Rf scalars was to impose dzx equal to some matrix dz bar x, right? The basic example was DP brains that have had normal boundary conditions in some directions and theory clay in some other directions. For those, that this matrix was just a bunch of ones followed by a bunch of minus ones. Now, G is dx mu psi mu. So if you want to impose this boundary condition on G, it's natural to require that psi mu z equals to plus or minus g mu nu psi z bar nu. And just like that. Okay. So we're going to glue the fermions, holomorphic and anthropomorphic fermions, together at the boundary, the same way as we glue the scalars up the choice of sign. Now, if this was a theory of free fermions, these two different choices will correspond to two different boundary conditions. In the presence of a GSO projection, things are a little bit more subtle. Now, to understand the subtlety fully, we require a certain a degree of understanding of Fermat field theory, which we just do not have at this stage. But I'm tempted to just go back to the example of the Ising model and just give you a feeling of what happens in that case. So the Ising model, if you remember, was a particularly simple example of GSO projection, where we had a theory of a free fermion, but we had to throw away some operators and put in the spin fields in order to get a good quantum field theory. So if I had a single fermion, the boundary condition could be something like psi equal to plus minus psi bar. What are the boundary conditions for an Ising model? Let's go back to the lattice. Right, so we had this lattice of spins. So the boundary conditions could be put to this lattice model. Well, one boundary condition would be to say that at the boundary, all spins are up. We call it DAP boundary condition. I could require all spins to be down. Or I can let the spins free, to be free. Now, how do I match these three boundary conditions to these two boundary conditions? Somehow, when the GSO projection, when you have a GSO projection, you don't just map a boundary condition to boundary condition. You need to do something a bit more refined. So let me call this B plus and B minus. So it turns out that the match works as follows. That one of them, say B plus, equals the direct sum of B up and B down. While the other one matches the free boundary condition. Now, this might look very bizarre, although if you go back and if you think hard enough about high temperature, low temperature duality. If you just implement high temperature, low temperature duality to the Ising model in the presence of boundary, you might find that the free boundary condition is indeed mapped to the sum of these boundary conditions. So what does it mean, the sum of boundary condition? The sum of two boundary conditions means that if you want to compute some correlation function, you compute it in the presence of this boundary condition, you compute it in the presence of this, and you add them together. Okay. So a similar thing happens in the superstring theory because of the GSO projection. You need to remix a bit the boundary conditions in the free fermion theory to get the boundary conditions in the GSO projected theory. So in particular, it turns out that the D-brains are described by a sum of these two boundary conditions. So it can define a boundary condition for the free fermions attached to this matrix and with the plus sign, or boundary condition attached to this matrix with the minus sign. You add them together, and you get the D-brains you get the correct boundary condition to describe D-brains. Okay. So, at this point, we're ready to do some calculations. I mean, you see that this taking this direct sum is very natural and absolutely necessary. But it's hard to justify it before starting the discussion. So I just state it, and then you'll see that it makes sense. The first way to see that it makes sense is that you don't want your D-brains to create states that don't exist in your theory. Right? That would be bad. And if you take either of these two D-brains, they create both GSO even and GSO odd states. But because they are related by switching the sign of the fermions on one side, and you remember GSO projection has to do with the fermion number on one side, on the Lomorphic side, say, or the anthropomorphic side, then by taking the sum of these two, you project out the GSO odd modes. So this brain creates a state, this brain creates a state, the sum of the states is GSO even. And so it's something that can be created in the theory. On the other hand, in this setup, having this direct sum essentially means that if you want to compute open strings between boundary condition, you really need to include both situations with plus and plus, or plus and minus. Okay. You might ask me, why don't you also look at minus minus and plus plus? And again, the GSO projections have been killing. There's the GSO projection done on op. Sorry, not the GSO projection. It's just the way the rules work. Sorry. There is. Okay. Well, I could do better than that, but let me see. No, sorry, this was not a fair statement. Let me do better. So indeed, one has to have all possibilities. But what really is going on is that the sum of these boundary conditions gives you the sum of two boundary conditions in the superstring. Something you could call as the boundary condition for a brain plus the boundary condition for an antibrain. So when you do things properly, you need to consider all four sectors, and then we disentangle the parts that correspond to open strings between the brain and itself, and open string between a brain and an antibrain. So, for example, so let me just describe what happens before doing the digital projection and disentangling, okay? There is plus plus, plus minus, there is also minus plus and minus minus, but minus minus behaves the same way as plus plus, and plus minus behave the same way as minus plus because they're related by a symmetry. So essentially when you do this, you're going to get something looks like an NS sector. So there will be the fermions will have half integral moding. You'll find things like a tachyon, a gauge field, and then you have to disentangle and figure out which one goes here and which one goes here. Well, from here, you get sort of a Ramon sector, something where the ground state carries spinor indices. So here, this will give you the spinors that live on the D-brain, and this one will give you the bosons that live on the D-brain. Okay, so let's start with the actual calculation. Well, I will only sketch, mostly because the calculation itself is not different from what we did in the bosonic string. Okay, if you remember in the bosonic string, we had some conditions something like that, which were solved by an exponential of a bilinear of A's. So we had in the bosonic string we had something like P plus A minus 1, A minus 1 bar, G mu nu, P plus dot dot dot. This was the bosonic string. These are the states created by D-brain in the bosonic string. Now in the fermionic, in the superstring, I still had this condition. And now I also have a similar condition for the psi's, for the modes of the psi. So I get, this is solved exactly in the same way. So the way these solve these sort of equations is that when I act it to say A1, it kills this, and it annihilates this creator. But this is the same as a bar minus one acting on this. So in a similar way, if I add to this sum things like psi minus one half mu, psi bar minus one half nu, g mu nu, p plus two dot, I can solve equations like that. Okay. So if you look at the states created in the NS sector by your D-brain, naively, there are both GSO odd and GSO even modes, but adding up these two sources eliminates the GSO odd ones. And you're left essentially with sources for your graviton or B field or dilaton, just as we saw for the bosonic string. Okay, so as far as the gravity is concerned, D-brains in the superstring work exactly the same way as D-brains in bosonic string. They describe extended objects in your space-time. For example, a D0 brain, which is something like zero space dimensions, will describe a particle. A D1 brain will describe a string, different from the usual string. A D2 brain will describe a membrane moving in this space-time. Now in the Ramon sector, now we don't create anything in the NSR or in the RNS, I think. But in the RR sector, we need to impose again this sort of equations. Now, in the RAR sector, crucially, there is an equation which involves the zero modes only. We don't care about the equations that involve the Auger oscillators because ultimately the massless modes have no oscillators. So this just ends up being a constraint on these two spinor indices, or these two spinor indices. So the polarization of the Ramon-Ramon states created by Hildebrand must be such that acting on it with gamma matrices on one index is the same as acting on it with gamma matrices on the other index up to this rotation. So you can guess that the correct way to solve this equation is to write this rotation matrix. This is an element of the rotation group. So in particular, it acts on spinors. And then I can use these matrices to solve this equation. So you can write the polarization of Ramon-Ramon fields built constructed by from the brain just in terms of these matrices. In particular, for the DP brain, where G is just a reflection in the Dirichlet directions, so it's a reflection in directions orthogonal to the brain. This matrix is the matrix which implements the reflection on spinors. And it's roughly the product on the directions perpendicular to the brain of gamma matrices. And the final result, if you go through the details, is that each of these DP brains sources precisely the Ramon fields of the same dimensionality. So I think I wrote it. Yes. So say the zero brain couples to F2, sources F2, like this. The one brain sources F3, like this, and so on and so forth. Now, because the number of indices is somehow correlated to 2A or 2B, you might expect that also the number of this, the fact this P being even or odd somehow must be correlated to being in type 2A and type 2B. Essentially, half of the brains, if I live in type 2A, the zero brain, the two brains, the four brains, the six brains, are able to emit Ramon-Ramon fields. The one, the three, the five are neutral just because there are no Ramon fields they can source. But as we'll see momentarily, they're also unstable. So in type 2A, there are some brains which are stable, have no tachyon, and source Ramon fields. And then there is a second class of D brains which do not source Ramon fields, but are unstable. They have a tachyon and they like to decay. Similarly here, the one, you can have the one, the three brains, which source Ramon fields and are stable. And then some unstable D brains, such as a tachyon on the world volume. And as you can guess, unstable D brains are not terribly interesting and usually are ignored just because they don't really exist in the interacting theory. They disappear, they promptly disappear. But the stable D brains are definitely very useful. And, okay. So now let's look at open strings. So we have a strip. So at one end of the strip, I set psi equal to say psi bar. At the other end of the strip, I can set psi equal to plus or minus psi bar, depending of if I'm looking at this or I'm looking at this. And then I expand psi modes. And it turns out that in this, if I pick the plus sign, psi is expanded in sorry, I always forget if the minus sign. Anyway, in one of the two cases, psi is expanded in a half integral mode. Let's call that the NS sector. And then there is another sector where psi is expanded in even modes, in integral modes. So here, the vacuum of the open strings would be S for the bosonic string. There will be something that looks like a tachyon, something that looks like a gauge field, or perhaps a position, a fluctuation in the position of your D-brain. So this is exactly as in the bosonic string. Here instead, I have ground states which have one spinor index because psi zero, because I need to quantize psi zero. So psi zero gives you some gamma matrices which act on the spinor index. And this gives me just a spinor that lives on the D-brain. Okay. So I have a theory which has a gauge field where this index lives parallel to the brain. I have some scalar fields whose index lives perpendicular to the brain and represent fluctuations of the D-brain. So this is the same as in the bosonic string. And then I have some spinors, a full single Majorana Weyl spinor in 10 dimensions. So this field content is very special. Is the field content for the maximally supersymmetric Yamil's theory. So if you write a gauge theory which has as much supersymmetry as you can, you get this field content. This is a theory which has 16 supercharges. So the closed string theory has 32 supercharges. But these D-brains, these are objects inside the theory which break some of the supersymmetry, break precisely half of the supersymmetry. And so they support some field theory with 16 supercharges. So this is what you find if you have a brain and another brain. If you take a brain and an antibrain, instead you find a tachyon, which makes sense because brain and antibrains want to annihilate. Or if you put an unstable brain, a brain that has no Ramon-Ramon sources, again, you find a tachyon. And the brain is willing to decay. Again, perhaps that makes sense. If the brain is sourcing Ramon fields, it really cannot decay into strings because the strings don't source them. But if a brain does not source Ramon-Ramon fields, there's nothing to prevent it from decaying into strings. And usually, so if something is not impossible, it happens in quantum field theory. And so this tachyon expresses the fact that this D-brain can decay. So we find a big, nice zoo of objects in this superstring theory. Right? There are the fundamental strings. There are these D-brains. As I said, in type 2A, you have the zero, D2, D4, D6, I guess D8 too. And in type 2B, you have D1, D3, D5, D7, and actually also D9 brains. D9 means it extends in 9 space directions, so it fills the whole of space. It actually is a little bit sick by itself because it's trying to source a field that is not dynamical. It has to be augmented by some other objects which have the opposite charge under this dynamical field and which have not encountered yet, which are called orbifold or antifolds. So if you put a bunch of these denying brains together with an appropriate orientifold, you get a theory which is called type 1 string theory. And then, but then there are all these other objects. Same way, the 8 is kind of funny. Sorry, there's no sources. It's source of an F minus 1. But it has some told. This guy sources this non-dynamical guy, which is called the Ramon mass. Now, this is more or less all I can tell you about superstring theories. And I won't have time to tell you, unfortunately, almost anything about dualities or superstring theories, although it's a very interesting subject. I can perhaps catch very quickly that here we had a fundamental string, and we have a D-brain, which is also a string. This couples to the B-field. This guy couples to the true form associated to the to the Ramon sector. Now, if you write down the type 2B, the supergravity effective action, the supergravity action, it actually has a symmetry, which is pretty much very similar to an electromagnetic. Well, it's a, which is a sort of mixes among themselves, the various, the two different true forms, the B field and the Ramon one. And it acts in interesting ways on the dilaton and the axion, and acts as, well, I mean, it sort of maps the three brain back to itself and so on. Well, maps a five back to itself. And now we found that we have objects which are for all of these, associated to all of these fields, which source all of these fields. And these objects have charges which are symmetric under this transformation. So, for example, there is an F1, but there is also a D1. And one of the string dualities is in the statement that if you take type 2B and you go a very strong string coupling, you find another copy of type 2B at weak coupling, where the role of fundamental strings is played by D-brains. So in the original weak coupling setup, this is very light, fluffy, and makes everything happen. This is very heavy with a tension which is proportional to 1 over the coupling. When the coupling is made larger and larger, this becomes lighter and lighter. This becomes comparably heavier. At some point, this guy becomes fluffier and more important low energy, and the role gets completely exchanged. On the other hand, if you, the 10-dimensional supergravity, which corresponds to type 2A, is actually a dimensional reduction of an 11-dimensional supergravity. So there's an 11-dimensional supergravity which, if you put it on a circle and make the circle small, starts looking like touch away. And if you look at the quantum numbers, you discover that the zero brain has just the same quantum numbers as a Kaluza-Klein mode for the graviton, for the 11-dimensional graviton would have. And the tensions and properties of, say, the fundamental strings and the D2 brains are precisely those that you would associate to a 11-dimensional membrane, which has been wrapped on the circle to become a string, or not, and so on and so forth. And so this leads to the idea of M-theory, which is a mysterious 11-dimensional theory with no coupling, which, if you put it on a circle, gives you type 2a, where the coupling is proportional to the size of the circle. So when the circle is very small, you find perturbable type 2a. Vice versa, when the coupling is very large, somehow an 11th dimension opens up, and you find M theory. And all of these reasonings are possible because of, in part because of supersymmetry. The masses and tensions of all of these objects are not corrected by quantum effects because they preserve some supersymmetry. And that's what allows you to match their masses and tensions and properties from weak coupling to strong coupling and make conjectures about dualities. Okay.